Hello and welcome to this episode of Superhero Ethics. Yes, Superhero Ethics fans, I promise I have not forgotten you, even though so many things have been all Kenobi all the time. We've had a couple of episodes lined up for you. One of them I had to cancel due to getting sick. Another one we had some audio problems, so we're going to have to re-record it. It's just been a little bit of a circus of chaos around here. But myself and Paul Hoppe pulled together a topic we've been talking about wanting to talk about for a while. We're going to do a little bit of a grab bag for you, but we're starting with the idea of those darn kids. You know, looking at why is it that when media wants to tell us that someone's really bad, they want to tell us that something is a real problem, they put kids in danger. And like, what does that say about the way our society values life in general and the emphasis it puts on kids' lives and all the many topics that come out of that, plus whatever the heck is on our minds. So it's a grab bag episode focusing on kids, focusing on some other questions, probably talk about some content warnings. We'll get into a whole bunch of stuff. All that more with myself and Paul Hoppe right after this commercial break that I have absolutely zero control over.
Circus of Chaos. Welcome back to Circle of Chaos.
Mwahahaha. That was Paul Hoppe. This is Matthew Fox. I use they, them pronouns. And we are glad to be back talking to you, Mr. Hoppe. What's on your mind? How does this topic of kids come to for you?
It's Master Hoppe. But no. I've probably been called Master Hoppe by kids more than, definitely more than Mr. Hoppe. But
I mean, the state of California through the university system did recognize that I am a master of divinity.
Sure.
So
yeah.
I think we each have, through our various schooling systems, a recognized claim to the title of master.
That's true. And that feels very relevant since Anakin was so very put out that he did not receive the title of master.
He was.
You know?
He was.
I could see that being irksome. But, you know, wouldn't lead me to go kill a bunch of kids.
Well, and so that's kind of the jumping off point for this episode. And we're not going to get into things specific to the Kenobi TV show. So no spoilers for that. If you want to hear more of our discussion on that, please go to the Star Wars Universe podcast where we've been doing episode by episode coverage. But I think it is no surprise to someone, you know, you're fairly disconnected from Star Wars, you probably know that a major plot point is Order 66, during which our hero who becomes the villain, Anakin Skywalker, goes to kill a whole bunch of Jedi, including a scene that is, I think, quite validly seen as very emotionally powerful, in which he is known to kill younglings, to kill little kids. But it's led to some conversations, especially how it's come up in other things and the way this issue's come up in a lot of our other media about why is it that when a show wants to tell us that something is really bad, it's not okay to just kill adults. You got to go into killing kids. And Paul, this is a topic I know you have a lot of thoughts on. So kind of take it away. What's kind of your feelings on this?
I do have a lot of thoughts. I'll start by just saying, you know, categorically, you know, killing kids is awful, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think we can probably mostly all agree on that, I would say. Yeah. I would hope. But, like, you know, killing adults is horrible as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, killing, you know, even, like, older people is horrible as well. And I think those three things kind of are, not that older people aren't adults, but I mean, like, I think people are treated differently in terms of how their lives are valued by other people, by society or whatever. And I mean, I think all animal lives and, you know, are valuable as well. And killing is horrible, just like broadly speaking. But, you know, I guess I am in a comfortable place feeling like I don't share society's opinion in the first place, mm-hmm. right? But to me, it's like if killing kids is a 10, then killing adults is a 10, you know, and killing an adult, no matter how old or young they are, is a 10. Like, you know, and granted the context of like, okay, well, this is self-defense or this is like clearly malicious or whatever. I mean, not that there's like non-malicious, like self-defense versus like in some sort of like, you know, elevated scenario versus just like outright murder, right? These things, I think,
right.
I think sometimes perhaps, you know, the murder of children is seen as particularly bad because because kids are seen as particularly defenseless, right?
Right.
And so that's a point I'm sympathetic to, right? It's like, okay, murdering somebody, you know, it's like shooting someone in the back of the head compared to, like, you know, draw. You know, it's like, okay, well, both are bad, but, like, one, the other person has so very little agency. And personally, I hate the way society treats children. I think kids should have much more choice and power over their own lives and agency, both in reality and in fiction. But I do think that there is, you know, and I mean, the word patronizing kind of feels very appropriate here, but, like, this idea of, like, well, there's nothing worse than killing a child because of, like, all the potential future. And, you know, I think that, taken to its illogical conclusion, it has a, you know, it leads us to, like, arguments over abortion and and choice, right?
Sure. I think, you know, like, I've always thought there's a lot of things I think are ridiculous about the anti-abortion, the anti-choice perspectives, the forced birth perspectives, we should call them.
Yeah.
But one thing I've always thought of, especially those folks who will say that they are happily, you know, they hate abortion and they're perfectly in favor of the death penalty or things like that.
Right.
And often what they'll say is, like, that it's that fetal life is innocent, that it's the perfect possibility and all that kind of thing.
Yeah,
I think kind of feeds into what you're saying, that it's a problematic way of viewing things.
For sure. And I think children are viewed that way a lot. When it's like, you know, by the time someone's 10, they've probably done some bad things, you know?
Yeah.
They've probably done some great things, too, you know? And it's like, that's just life.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think some lives should be dramatically more valued than others based on, you know, how many years they've lived.
Right. One thing that occurs to me, and I'm curious how you would see this, is because I think that if as a society we value the lives of kids more, then that is a problem. I do, though, wonder how, because, and like, to give another example from our own lives, you know, in the last couple weeks, we've had two horrible mass shootings, one that happened in Buffalo and was driven by very explicitly racist reasons, and was mostly it was adults who were killed. And then another that happened in a school in Texas, and the reasoning of it is less clear. It seems there was less of, like, kind of a political motivation, more of just a person with, like, a deeply mentally troubled person or whatever it may have been. And that person killed young kids. And the way the media portrayal has done, it would be very easy to forget that the Buffalo killing ever happened. You know, it's been so much more about the Texas killing. And I think I have a reason for that I want to kind of throw out to you, but I wanted to start by saying, to you, is that further proof of the kind of thing that you're talking about the way that as a society we sort of see the killing of kids as much more outrageous and much more of a problem than the killing of adults?
Absolutely. And I mean, I'll just, you know, for the thousandth time, like, reiterate that, like, I don't feel a part of this we, you know,
yes.
but I understand what you're saying for sure. And yeah, I do. I think it's also partly like the news cycle and sensationalism and that kind of thing. Right. Like, I think there's a number of factors here. I also think there were a bunch of other shootings recently that, like, don't even, like, there was someone on a New York subway, right, who went in and tried to kill a bunch of people. Then there were some other, maybe they didn't kill as many people, so it didn't make headlines as much. But yeah, absolutely. I think that the Texas martyrs, like, were occupied a larger place in sort of the public discourse, largely because there is this, like, bonus outrage kind of, you know, when it comes to kids. And so, yeah.
So here's the theory I would throw back at you, and I'm curious, and also to be clear, whenever I say, like, we as a society, I recognize that I'm talking about me and everyone else addressing you, the person who stands outside everything.
Fair. I appreciate that.
And I make
that.
A little bit of fun that. Of you about
Thank
that. Because
that's fine.
I think you're a little more part of society than you want to think, but I also think you're a lot less part of society than me calling you we would indicate.
Sure, fair.
There's middle ground there. And also the we can be so changing, you know, like.
Sure.
American society is such a, like, there's 8 million things that go into that. Million different we's.
Yeah, or like 340 million or something.
Yeah, well, 170.
I mean, 340 choose, you know, 339 million. So, like, really the number is, like, very, 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 very large.
No math. But, no math. This is a math-free podcast. 67% of this podcast must have no math. Anyway, the other 37 can have made-up statistics.
Oh, no. You had to just go pick two numbers then. Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, no, 67 and 33. Yeah, I did the
seven. Yeah, okay. Plus. I thought that was on purpose just to irk me.
I was close. No, it's just bad memory skills, bad math skills.
Fair.
Here's the thing that I would say as a counterpoint is that, and this maybe gets into sort of the problems with when media does it, there is something I think inherent in most people, particularly people who are parents, that is a, like, we must protect our kids. And that can translate to we should protect kids. And part of that is also, you know, this kind of idea of, like, it is, you know, that kids are supposed to bury their parents. Parents aren't supposed to bury their kids, mm-hmm. to take a line from one of my father's favorite movies. I think it's about, like, a kind of a guy who holds a hospital hostage to make them pay for the medical stuff for his kid. I never saw it. It seemed like a interesting critique of healthcare, but a kind of ridiculous premise. But that line is repeated. It's one they hear a lot. That, like,
The Two Towers also has something like that.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Right,
that's
where... the king of Rohan buries his son.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder if – how much do you think it is kind of like a societal, like, valuing of kids' lives higher as much as it is a feeling, particularly in those people who have been parents, but also can bleed into many other people as well, of we are – our job is to protect everyone, but to protect our kids especially. Because, like you said, they're defenseless, because they're not fully seen adults, which we can say is problematic. Like, what role do you think that can – and also just, I mean, there is a genetic component of, like, you know, infants in almost all species have big, cute eyes because it keeps us from eating the youth.
Right, like, right.
It's a – gross generalization of evolution, but, like, there is an evolutionary aspect that causes us to feel a protective nature towards youth. How much do you think that plays into, like, those kind of things?
How much? But I can't use math, right? Okay. So just I'll kind of hand wave it and say I think there's multiple factors. I do think the kind of, like, biological imperative is surely a big part of it, right? It's not just, like, societal and, you know, this sort of software that, like, we've downloaded collectively regardless, or, you know, or that we've been subjected to and attempted to reject and be like, no, wipe that off my hard drive, you know.
I like the idea that capitalism is malware.
I mean, not just capitalism, but
a lot of things.
But yeah, I think there is, I'm sure, some sort of hardwired, like, you know, humans are basically programmed to think little humans are cute so that they don't want to eat them. And, like, so they want to try and protect them so the species can go on. You know, personally, I'm, like, not that interested in the species, like, going on, like, as if humans are so important. But, like, fine, if that's good and important to you, cool. You know, I mean, like, yeah, I mean... like, children are, like, the future, but, like, so right. are really their children's are more the future, but, like, not, you know, I mean, the future's just the future. And, okay, I'm now like, leaning towards the whole space-time thing.
Is now superhero metaphysics.
Right. We'll back off of that a bit. But, you know, I do think that there is a sort of, not in terms of, like, ethics or morals or valuing in terms of, like, thinking, you know, how someone matters in some, like, special way that everyone's special and, like, you know, kids are extra special because they haven't done a bunch of bad stuff or, like, you know, they have more years in front of them, you know, unless they get killed, on average, though. But I do think that there's a fair component of just, like, utility of the idea that, like, oh, you know, these kids are going to be useful to society and the propagation of the species, and right. thus we must protect them, you know? And, like, right. again, like, yeah, protecting kids, good. Do that for sure. But just don't do that to the exclusion or at the expense of protecting, you know, adults as well.
Right.
And also, I don't think there's such a hard line between, you know, I mean, it's more of a gradual change anyway.
I think it's fair. And I think part of why I bring that up is because for me at least, like, I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think the fact that, like, yeah, even me, I'm not a parent. I don't want to be a parent. If I read about a 30-year-old person being killed, I think that's terrible. If I read about a 10-year-old being killed, I have a different emotional reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that may be genetic. Part of that may be programmed. I think it's good to unpack that a little bit, but I don't think that that's inherently a bad thing. I think what really bothers me is the degree to which media uses that to manipulate me, you know, and
yes.
Like, because I think, you know, one of my best examples of this is I feel like in so often in superhero or action movies, you'll get a scene where all of a sudden there's a cute little kid who does something cute for 20 seconds, like they lose their doll or they have a cute moment with their mom or they buy an ice cream cone. And so all of a sudden you feel emotionally invested, not just in, will all these people in this, you know, adventure park be eaten by this dinosaur, but will this one little kid? To me, the most egregious example of this is, and here I have a good reason to bash the particular person I'm bashing, in the original version of Justice League. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's this idea that, like, all this area in Russia is going to be harmed.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, we get, like, 3 minutes of this Russian family with these cute little kids doing cute little kid things for no other reason other than to establish the emotional stakes.
Right.
You know? And I get it. You know, one of the things that I learned when I was doing political advocacy is, if I tell you that this terrible thing happened to 5,000 people, that has one level of emotional effect. But if I say, let me tell you about Betty, and Betty was this person, and she did this thing happened to Betty, and then, by the way, also it happened to 5,000 other people, that's a much more effective way to reach you, you know? And so I get why they have to do it. I find, especially when it is just kind of like so shoehorned in for no good reason and so blaringly obvious of it's just and so therefore when it's a kid, especially, it just really bothers me.
Yeah, it plays to me like crass manipulation, emotional manipulation, mm-hmm. you know, and
yeah.
I think that's what it is. And but like, you know, filmmakers do it, the news does it because it's effective. And
right. First
of all, like, yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with having a different emotional reaction. You know, that's, I mean, you're, first of all, like, your feelings are your feelings, right? Accept
right. Them.
And if any of them give you real issues, then maybe think about what you can do, right? But
denying that you're feeling what you're feeling is just never actually going to get you anywhere.
Right. That's never the starting point, right? I do think that sometimes, you know, you can have a feeling and feel like it maybe represents something you'd like to change about yourself. And mm-hmm. then, you know, maybe go about doing that, whether it's like, oh, did I, you know, not value these characters' lives because, like, they were brown people? Or, like, did I only value this woman's life because she was attractive, but then there was another woman who I didn't think was attractive and, like, I didn't value her life as much? I don't love that about myself. Maybe I'll see if I, you know, how I can kind of change how I think about things. Or
do some
things. Unpacking
of where these feelings come
right,
from.
Right, exactly. And again, like, I think that's a spot where you need to, like, be compassionate with yourself and understanding and be like, you know, you've been programmed to feel that way to some extent, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, reprogramming yourself is work. And, you know, but yeah, I do think that feeling a certain way is one thing, but then doing particular things to try to shape a narrative in order to manipulate people is another thing. And like sometimes the goal of that is something that you think is worthwhile, right? When it's like maybe some sort of activism. Or maybe you're in the news and you're like, well, we want this story to have emotional impact because it really is quite a horrible thing that happened.
Right.
And so you painted a way to try and play that up. And yeah, I mean, to your example, I will say you started with 5,000 and then you had 5,001. So that was actually more. but people are bad at math and big numbers just don't – like people don't have to be bad at math, but I kind of feel like people choose to be. But not everybody chooses to be. Okay, I'll roll that back. I think in general – people could interact more effectively with numbers, especially if the way that numbers were taught were more effective and less like wrong, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But the point, to your point, is like, yeah, like big numbers, I think most people do not have a very clear concept, and that doesn't give a very personal, you know, like, it's like, oh, okay, 1 million to 4 million people died. Okay, that I guess that sounds like a lot. But that's less than the Holocaust, so maybe it's not that many. It's like,
I'm not often going to quote Joseph Stalin on this, but I do think his line that one death is a tragedy, 100,000 deaths is a statistic, is actually very telling. You
right.
Because it's like, you're right. It's like the personal feeling of just like, oh, my God, I can't believe that happened. Yeah, it's you know, when you hear about the death, when you see the pictures of the bodies, when you see these kind of things. But when it's like, oh, was it 80,000 or 100,000? At that point, it's become now so much more. I'm trying to think of the word. It's not that's esoteric.
I think theoretical.
It's theoretical. That's a perfect example. Right. Yeah, it's just like you said, it's a statistic. It's right. No longer about this particular connection you have with a person.
Yeah, for sure.
I know one of our favorite movies is Desperado. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about how you feel about this, because Desperado to me is another good example of how this can get kind of weird, where, you know, forgive me for spoilers for a movie that's 20 years old at this point. We did, if you want to pause it though, we did do
yeah,
a great
yeah,
episode
go listen
on it
to our episode.
Long, long ago. but in, you know, in one of the final climactic scenes, our hero's two best friends come to meet him and they have this epic showdown. And both of his friends get shot, or one of them gets shot. They both get shot.
One gets also like has blown like a, up, right?
A rocket. Yeah. Rocket. So yeah. He's probably totally gone.
Right.
The other one may be dead. We don't know. But there's also been this local kid hanging around who's connected for a hero for maybe a total of like 20 minutes over 3 days. He's also shot. Our hero grabs the little kid, rushes to the hospital without a thought about his two best friends who just got killed, maybe. And like, I think it's you know, that to me feels less egregious than like in Justice League, because at least that kid was established as a character, and like his father, you know, he was using his guitar to deal drugs and was part of it, like his character was established into the plot.
Yeah.
But it still, I thought, was a kind of like, okay, I see what you're doing there, that you want us to, like, oh, the kid got killed instead of it being his best friend.
Right.
You know?
Or didn't get killed but got shot and
right.
thus there's, or injured somehow. Yeah, I think his friends are not showing up in the sequel. You know?
That's very true.
I'll say that. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people get killed in that movie, right? And there is this, like, you know, using the kid in that manner. I think that's a good example. I do think that it's different than, say, the Justice League example, or like every superhero cartoon ever when there's a fire in a building and someone's like, my baby, you know,
oh,
and then
God,
they'll like
yeah.
flash us, like run up the side of the building and be like, oh, here. And, you know, it's like, I mean, I don't think kids shouldn't be in things, you know, I mean, I think there should be kids in things. Right. And the fact that that kid in that movie is like a character who has a real conversation on a couple of occasions with
right.
The main character, I think makes it play very different than if it had just been like some random kid where it just feels like, oh, let's just, you know, do
yeah.
this. You know, there is the expression like, you know, save the cat, kick the dog or something like that, right? Where, you know, you want to show that someone's bad, like you show them kicking a dog or something. Or,
right.
you know, you want to show that they're a hero, you literally show them saving a cat, like in the Superman movies, you know. And, you know, I mean, on the one hand, it's nice that, like, to see animal lives actually valued to some extent, right? Of course, these are generally pets, which are valued disproportionately to other animals. But yeah, it's like there's these things that, you know, it doesn't always have to be a kid. Like, you could have an adult, you know, and it's like there's – you could kind of try to find a way of maybe diversifying your, like, people who need to get saved and elicit an emotional reaction from the audience. And honestly, I think you could do that really easily with, like, you just have a couple lines of dialogue. Like, you show, you know, a – 10 seconds of them just being human, you know?
Yeah.
Or if they're an animal, being an animal and just doing their thing, you know?
Like, it doesn't have, it could be the stray cat in the building. It doesn't have to be the pet, you know?
Sure,
it could
yeah,
be
exactly.
The, like, you know, the horse on someone's farm, you know?
Yeah, or just like a goat somewhere. I don't know where goats are, but I saw a goat like on the side of a mountain one time. I'm like, oh, that there's a goat. Okay, I might
mean,
goat.
Goats are in mountain areas.
Yeah, like, so like, you know, like that, I don't know, I'd like to see that. You know, Mount Rushmore's falling, collapsing. This is actually where I saw a goat. We drove by Mount Rushmore, and then there was this like goat standing on the side of some like mountainy thing. And like, I don't know, you see a mountain collapsing, and then like superheroes like, oh, I'm going to save the goat.
Yeah.
I don't know, I'd like that.
Because you're right, and I admit that is something that you have really helped me to have a better understanding of, is that, you know, to me, and I don't want to get us too deep into this topic, but I think it's tied in as we're talking about the ways we value life. You know, there's always the kind of like the trolley problem is the best example. But these kind of movies, like, you know, our hero has two rooms that are on fire. And often the question is like, do you save the one person you love, or do you save like the 10 strangers? And the idea being that you want them to save the 10 strangers, but you also understand why they save the person that they love. And then, but then also becomes like, but what's your actual professional responsibility? You know, like the cops, for example, in that Texas town who rescued their own kids instead of facing danger to save other people's kids. For me, I think if I saw like, okay, in this room, there's three people, and in this room, there's three animals. Like, to me, that's a no-brainer in terms of, I am going to value the human life higher. And I think talking with you about it has kind of maybe at least questioned like, okay, but why is that? You know, why is it that I established that kind of life is of a higher value than others? Because I, for you, I think like that wouldn't be an easy question, right? It's three lives in either case.
Yeah. I mean, these type of hypotheticals, I'm always like, all right. I mean, this isn't how things really like happen, right? But like,
I mean, but it's how it happened in the movies all the time.
No, I know, and those are not scenes that I'm like, okay, we're doing this one again, you know.
Right.
The only time I enjoy it is in The Good Place when they're like doing a thing out of it, you know.
Right.
Like that's a different story.
I think like what happened with the cops in Uvalde, or like like firemen face situations like this a lot, you know, where it's like, okay, which room do you try to rescue people out of first, you know? And like they're taught specific calculus about how they're supposed to do it and things like that.
I mean, for me, I think – so like in terms of like risk-reward assessment, it's like which of the – like it's not like they're going to be two equidistant rooms that are going to have exactly the same logistics, you know? If it's like, well, this room, I think I can definitely get in and get people out. Okay, I'll do that. But, you know, also – so here is where like, you know, saving kids versus saving, you know, middle-aged people versus saving older people. Like, you know, maybe it is like, yeah, who has a chance to get out on their own? That might be the last person I help, but maybe there's somebody I can help and then they can help get someone else out and maybe that's going to work. Personally, in terms of like decisions like that, like you just do the best you can. Like you immediately try and help whoever's closest to you, I think, and then you go and try and help the next person. That's how I see it. And I basically like reject the premise of like, you know, I mean, in terms of theoretically, like I'm not really asking humans to put human and non-human animal lives on exactly the same level. Like, I think that's too much to ask. Like, that's just not what's going to happen. For some people, some people are like, oh, I would definitely save the animals and like the humans can, you know, burn. Like, that's fine. I feel you, you know. But like for me, it's just like asking for a level of consideration that puts, you know, those lives above a human's comfort, you know, and pleasure and whatever. And yeah, it's like, you know, for me, it would just honestly be a logistical, like what do I think I can actually effectively accomplish here? You know?
No, and I get that. And I think, when I studied ethics in grad school, you know, one of the people we studied with had done like ethical consulting for the fire department. And they said that, that the idea is you're always supposed to be taught to just do what you can in the moment. But that also you should recognize, like that you need to be able to recognize when is it that you look in the two rooms and see, okay, that one is clearly more important? And how is it like your own biases are playing into that? Right. And is that a problem? You know, so that's the like, we're never going to want someone to sit down and do the like, okay, let me ethically ponder this building is falling apart.
Yeah, that's just, that's not a thing. That's
yeah. But that like how these things play out, you know, in turn, you know, that our racial and our ethnic and our ageist and all these biases do affect us in those kind of ways, you know? And I think that's, to me, that's the reason why these conversations are interesting, especially because of the way the media, you know, because I think, yeah, if you grow up, if everything you watch always says save the kids first, then that's what you're taught. That's what you learn.
Right. Women and children first. Okay. That's a whole other thing too.
I mean, the gender part of it's also right. A whole other thing. Like, but yeah. And so it is like, you know, yeah, like, because I think you're right. I think those theoretical things are never going to be as exact and as perfect as the theoretical discussion. I just think it is helpful at least to discuss it because it does – it shapes and informs the biases and also how we look at the media that talks about it all.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, it's more like I think the conversation can begin and end with like make the decision based on the logistics basically. Don't – you know, be aware of whatever biases you might have and then try and – not have right. those factor in, right? And right. and in order to do that, I don't think that's something that you do at the moment. I think that's you do like away from the table in like poker speak, you know, like on yeah. your own, be like, let me try and reduce these biases in myself. Because I think that's right. a thing a person can do, right? Yeah. I mean, I think that's work you can do.
I mean, I think it's kind of, like, I think for a lot of people, again, like it's hard to predict what anyone does in the moment. But I think like even just for myself, if I saw like two kids in one room and five adults in another, I'm probably trying to rescue the two kids,
mm-hmm.
you know? And then, and this conversation is kind of a way of thinking about like, oh, actually, is that what I should be? Is that a bias I should be having? Is that a bias I shouldn't be having? You know? And what are the things that have taught me that that's how to value these things?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, for me, like strategically, I'd be like, well, you know, if it's a group of like apparently able-bodied adults, like if I can make it so that they can get out on their own, maybe I could recruit some of them. And it's like, if you're a professional firefighter, maybe that's not how you think. But if right. you're a person in an emergency situation, on the other hand, if it's like, oh, it would be useful to have a kid who could crawl through this thing and then move that thing, I'm like grabbing a kid first. I'm like, hey, kid, help me with this. All right, okay, I'll lift this thing off you. Go on, get under there, unlock that door. Thank you. Okay, let's go. You know?
Yes.
That's exactly how I would sound in one of these situations, by the way.
The exasperation in your voice is the very essential part of that as well.
Hey, kid, come here. All right, so dismissed.
In terms of the way stories use that then, what do you think of the Order 66 scene in Revenge of the Sith, where you do see Anakin walk in? Because I'll say for me... And again, this is one of those times where it's the question of, like, are you judging a person based on our own moral standards or on theirs?
Right.
I think that Anakin definitely has a very strong protect kids first.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Anakin, like, it didn't feel gratuitous either when they said that he killed the Tuskens in the second movie or when you see him – happily, we don't see him kill kids in the third movie, but we see him – pretty clearly about to kill kids, you know.
Right,
with the,
right.
Like,
it's implied, but I mean, very explicitly implied.
And it's the perfectly toe-headed, most adorable little boy they could find, which is part of also a little bit eye-rolly for me.
Sure.
But like, to me, those scenes feel like they're not gratuitous in that they're showing how far Anakin is crossing a line that we know that he would have, and we know that anyone around him would have. How do they feel to you?
Yeah, so I'm not sure I actually saw that scene because my eyes were still stuck up in the top of my head from the eye roll after Mace Windu's massive backswing instead of just running the Emperor through. But
that's fair.
If I recall what happened, I think that's a really good point in terms of the distinction between we are creating this scene to make the audience feel something particular and mm-hmm. we are creating this scene in order to say something about the character. And I imagine the motivation was probably both, right? Mm-hmm. That on the one hand, I think it works very well as far as, you know, the Emperor getting Anakin to do something that's so far across a line for Anakin that he doesn't think Anakin will ever come back from that, you know, right. Whoopsie, guess you were wrong. But it took a while, right?
Mm-hmm.
But like, I think it definitely works on that level, and I appreciate that. And I don't have any problem with the scene in and of itself, you know. Overall, all the clones attacking the Jedi and that somehow actually working, that's a whole different thing, right? That's mm-hmm. actually the part of Order 6 that really, like, annoys me. And I'll be honest, I find the clones killing all these Jedi that I know who they are more upsetting than killing a bunch of anonymous children, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If yeah. those kids had been developed more and... If they were, like, if I'd seen the Clone Wars TV series first, and then mm-hmm. a bunch of those kids who we'd seen were in that scene, right. that
the
would
hit
Wookiee different.
The little Wookiee Jedi and all the little Padawans who go look for their lightsabers.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that would hit so differently. And you can think, oh, well, maybe, well, it was those kids, or those kids were there, right? And then that adds some emotional resonance, I think, you know? And but that's because they're people. They're characters who've been developed. Here, they're just like, all right, they're cute, but, like, I don't know them. And it's not like yeah. I can't feel something for someone I don't know, but, like, I definitely feel more for someone I know, you know, for sure. And so I do think that was a combination of, you know, some level of emotional manipulation, which I think was, you know, a lot going on in that movie and the previous movie, and combined with, like, no, something that was very reasonable in story as far as how Order 66 played out. That is the part that I think makes kind of the most sense. From a character yeah. standpoint.
I can see that. There's a related topic I want to transition us into. Is there anything else on this topic of sort of just the specific idea of the kind of ageism and how we value different lives at different ages that you wanted to comment on?
I mean, I could go into a whole thing, but I don't think... I will say... Yeah, okay. I'll do this. So... I remember when – so my dad died when he was 41 and I was 8. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that sucked. Like, that was a very formative moment for me in terms of kind of, like, understanding the world and life and death. And I do think, you know, like, on the one hand, like, I learned a lot from it. Mm-hmm. And – but on the other hand, like, obviously a very traumatic experience for me – and my mom, right? And,
right.
you know, I remember my dad's parents. I remember that was the first time that I realized that idea of, like, oh, like, a child dying before their parents is kind of a particular thing, you know? Right. Similar to, like, a child's parents dying before they're an adult, you know?
Yeah.
Is also a different particular thing. And
jumping in for that a second. Yeah, like, my mother died when I was, you know, in my 30s, and it sucked and it had a major effect on me. But just in the way you and I have talked, I think it affected us in very different ways because of exactly what you're talking about.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. You know, and obviously one thing could affect one person in a different way than the same timing and whatever affected another person, right? But I do think there are, you know, generally speaking, there's going to be some similarities based on, like, how old you are when someone you love dies, right? And someone who's a huge part of your life. It wasn't until, I think, sometime later that, like, I realized how much of, you know, of that tragedy was, like, was really, like, his tragedy, right? Like, mm-hmm. he was 41. He was a cameraman. You know, he worked in film and commercials and had just completed this program for, like, learning to be more of a cinematographer. And I think he'd been, you know, the director of photography on some commercials then and was trying to get more into, like, you know, TV and movies in that capacity. And, you know, he never got to do that. And, you know, he also never got to see his kid grow up. And I think he would have loved that I was into a lot of the things that I was into, you know? I mean, he's the person who taught me chess, you know? He liked sports and loved martial arts and music. And I think, you know, seeing that those were things that I got into, I think he would have really enjoyed that, you know? And that was something that we could have shared, you know? And I mean, my mom, we have a connection with those things as well. But, like, you know, that's that, but there's something else, you know? And so for him to never get those experiences, you know, and he'd also just, like, quit smoking and then he died of cancer, which is kind of, like, you know, hilarious in the way that things that are horrible are hilarious. So it's like, of course, right. Of course, you know.
But also, yeah, in those tragic moments, you find those moments of hilarity, you know.
Right, like, exactly. Like, there's humor in everything. It's just like, you know, I'll choose which parts I want to laugh at, you know. And don't tell me that something's fun.
Yeah. My mother had quit smoking around the time she got diagnosed with lung cancer. And then she was like, well, I'm going to start smoking again.
Yeah.
My sister were like, okay, I guess there's nothing we can say here.
She actually, like, snuck out of the hospital for a smoke, right?
Yep.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Anyway, sorry. You're
confused. No, it's fine. It's fine. But then I remember it was not that many years later that both of my mom's parents died. And at the time, you know, I was a teenager. I was like 16, 17, I think. And like, I remember sort of feeling this, like, I was like, well, but they're like in their 80s, you know, and like they had full lives, you know, they got to see their kids grow up, you know, they got to have a couple of grandkids, even though tragically one of their grandkids was like not allowed to see them by their totally out there mom, who was not, not their kid, but you know, but yeah, so I think I was like fairly like I was upset, right? Like I wasn't happy that my grandparents were dying. And like I understood that my mom was upset as well. But I think because I had had a very particular experience of having my dad die when I was a little kid, I don't want to say able, because that kind of like feels like a cop out, more like willing, or just I didn't, right? I didn't sympathize as well as I could have, I think, you know, with my mom when her parents died, because in some way I felt like, well, you're supposed to die when, you know, when you get to that age. And I mean, you know, there's an element of truth of like, yeah, nobody's lived to 150, right? I mean, unless you take the Bible literally, and then, you know, you got some Methuselahs and stuff. But like,
very Christian, I do not. You're not supposed to. Fair. The Bible says don't take itself literally.
Right.
So that's another story.
Yeah, kind of important point. But, you know. But like, you know, the point being, like, yes, humans die at some point, right? And so there is some extent to which you can say, okay, if you have lived a certain amount of time and you have done the things that you wanted to do, like, I can understand how a person would then be more at peace with dying at that point. And the people around them would maybe be comfortable with that. And like, this is kind of like a life complete or whatever, right? But at the same time, if that person's like, no, I want to keep living, like, I don't think their death is not a tragedy. You know, it's reality. It's like, and so I have a cousin who I found out, what's today? Thursday? I think I found out on Saturday. So within the last week, died of COVID, right? Mm. In Florida. And this is upsetting to me. You know, I feel this is a tragedy. When I tell someone that he's a cousin, I think a second cousin, maybe once removed. I'm not sure exactly how it works with the cousin numbers. That I never got cousin math. But, you know, when I tell you that he was 96, there's probably a different reaction than if you thought this was one of my cousins who's like 30, right?
Yeah, because I'll admit, when I hear the word cousin, I think someone who's your contemporary.
Right, exactly. You know? And it's like, I mean, we're cousins. Everyone's cousins if you go back far enough, right? Like, that's how it is. But yeah, so then it's like, oh, well, okay, well, yeah, you know. But, you know, he was sick for 3 weeks, miserably, having been quite healthy before that. And he was in a retirement home where they just had no COVID precautions because it's Florida. And, like, he definitely didn't need to die then. And he definitely didn't need to die that way, you know. And I do think there's an extent to which it's like, okay, the older a person is, to some extent, it's a little easier to me anyway to kind of accept like, yeah, eventually there's, you know, you can look at it like, well, there's less time lost, right?
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, he might have lived another week, he might have lived another month, a year, 10 years even. Like, people do live into their low hundreds, right?
Yeah.
Like, and some people do that in a very fulfilled, happy fashion. And some people are like waiting for death, right? And those are obviously very different experiences. And, you know, it's like, I just would like people to at least value other people's lives as much as those people value their lives, you know?
Yeah.
Not that you can't value it more than they do. That's fine, too. But, like, it, you know, it's just very upsetting to me how little I feel like people care about older people. And by older people, I mean, like, people older than them. You know, like most people, someone who's 10 or more years older, who's not directly related to them, they just don't seem to care that much. And I find that very upsetting.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I can think of two perfect examples of this. First of all, I just want to like honor like kind of what you've shared, and I really appreciate you kind of the vulnerability and talking about that stuff, because I think it's very true.
Thank you.
And for me, there's kind of two things that have come to mind, one real life, one in fiction, but that they both speak to this. You know, and one is like around COVID, you know, there was a lot of talk about like, oh, well, but the people who are most affected are the elderly, and that, you know, we shouldn't be worried about them as much. And just a lot of really horribly ageist discussion of the idea of who was at risk. The other part was, and I admit, I've never thought about this until this moment. I think if Obi-Wan Kenobi had been 40 years old in A New Hope, his death would have hit in a very different way.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is this element of he's lived a full life, he did what he needed to do, and this is kind of a nice coup de grace on his life. You know, this is a nice, like, I'm going to die soon, so I'm going to go out in the best possible way. And I think if Obi-Wan looked and was known to be a much younger person, where it's like, yeah, I'm sacrificing myself to Darth Vader, or I could be your mentor for 40 more years and do all the other things I could want to do for 40 more years, that would hit very, very differently.
I think so, too. And, I mean, to the point where, you know, Qui-Gon dying, I think, to most people feels more like a tragedy. Now, there is the aspect that Obi-Wan did actually seem to be sort of at peace with, okay, this is my decision, really.
Right.
Right. But I think that
Qui-Gon wanted to win that fight in a way Obi-Wan did not.
Right, exactly. I will say, though, I think that in terms of the writing, I think that's incredibly ageist because, I mean, first of all, Alec Guinness was like 60 then. And I'm not sure how old Obi-Wan actually now figures out to be. Like, I'm not sure exactly the math and, like, when he's supposed to be born. And I'll say years in Star Wars always, like, I know they have some kind of, oh, well, there's the core system and this, the yada, yada, yada. But, like, Obi-Wan... Yeah, he was like 60 and he was a Jedi. Like, could he not have trained Luke for another 40 years? No, it's this trope of like killing the mentor. And that partially is supposed to kind of like put the hero out on their own. But it's this idea that the story is the kid's story. And without getting into any of the details of the sequel trilogy, and without talking about like the new characters versus the old characters, I think the fact that all the old characters are treated like they are they are there for the service of the younger characters, basically, I kind of think is incredibly messed up, you know?
Yeah.
And is one of the things, one of the reasons that I basically was like, I'm not even going to watch the eighth movie before I even knew anything about what, I was just like 100% such and such is going to happen. I'm not really interested in that. I do have a little bit of a sort of counter to my own point, which is I believe that in the world in which we live in, or like the country in which, you know, I'm presently stuck, the United States, there is kind of the opposite when it comes to like yes, younger lives are valued more, except when it comes to like politics. In which case, granted, there's a lot of ageism. Someone's like, oh, would you say that, you know, no one should ever be allowed to be president when they're over 65? I'm like, no. But I mean, I also think 35 is like too high an age, but like whatever.
Right.
But the point being that I think there is way too much power concentrated in the hands of a small number of people who skew towards being older, whereas... Yeah. You know, whereas like value is placed on younger people's lives, which is this weird, really weird kind of dynamic, I think.
There's this wonderful speech by a Christian pastor. You may have seen it because it's been going around a lot, but it talks about how that like one of the most screwed up things about the whole like, you know, forced birth movement is that I wish I could remember the exact wording. If I could find it, I'll post it. But it says that like the unborn are a wonderful group to advocate for.
Mm.
And I think this is true for kids in general. is that because, like, you know, you advocate on behalf of women, well, women are likely to tell you, actually, we would like this, not that, right, you know, right. Like, same with most groups. But kids, especially the unborn, yeah. but also to younger kids in general, like, you can say, no, this is what kids need. This is what kids want, because they can never – they're never going to be ugly. They're never going to be actually not the – you know, think about how often, a black person gets killed by the police, and the immediate effort is to try to, like, say, oh, well, this wasn't a perfect black person. You know, they got – this person may have had some kind of, like, arrest in their past, or they had a fight with their romantic partner. Like, they weren't a perfect person. That shouldn't mean they get to be killed by the cops.
Right.
But it makes the story harder. There's nothing like that for the unborn. You know, right. for the you know, that what they call that, I would just say fetal life, you know, whatever it is. So I think that's true. I think another thing that came to mind a lot as you were talking, and this is kind of going back a bit, but I think for me, and I think this is somewhat problematic, there are deaths that we think of as expected and things that we feel are wrong, you know? Mm. And so, like, for an adult child to deal with the death of their adult parent, if the adult child dealing with the death of their non-adult parent, there's a whole other problem. But
people are into that whole step-parent thing and whatever. Yeah, I don't know.
If you are an adult, especially not like, you know, a college, if you have some adult experience in your life, for you to deal with the death of your parent, it's expected, you know? And I think it's kind of like what you're saying with your mother. Like, when my mother died, I was in my 30s. Mm-hmm. This wasn't a, like, oh, my God, I can't imagine that happened to you. Whereas I do think, like, you know, someone's parents dying when they're a child is in that level of, oh, my God, I can't believe this happened to you. And even more so, a parent dealing with the death of their child is in that level of, like, you know, and so I think that's a fairly recent thing. You know, like, 400 years ago, you were expected to try to have 5 children, because if 2 of them lived to age 5, you were winning. You know? Like, there's this thing in Jewish law that, like, and this is part of the gets into that whole choice stuff. Like, there are very rigid rituals in some parts of Judaism, not rigid, but, like, very known rituals in Judaism about what you're supposed to do when someone dies, in terms of, like, taking 7 days. That's where the word Shiva comes from, because right. It's Hebrew for 7, maybe Yiddish for 7, but, you know, of boarding. You're not supposed to do that unless the child is at least a week old, because at the time these traditions were come up with, the whole society would stop.
Right,
you know?
Right. The infant mortality rate was just so high.
Right. Whereas today, infant mortality is a huge tragedy. And I actually know, like, some Jewish activists who are trying to, like, change that, because it's like, you know, and all of which is just going to say, like, I think that, to me, it's part of why I think it is, and this is going to tie into kind of the next thing I wanted to talk about, although the number of times that Paul, you and I have said, okay, we can't really get a full topic out of this, let's tack on 2 or 3 things. It's 50 minutes, we've mostly had enough time on this, but I just want to connect it to a related thing, which is the idea of content warnings. And I think we'll have a different conversation at a different time about content warnings. I think, though, for me, having a content warning around the death of a child, I get why that's one where, in particular, people feel a need for it. I think because, again, it's the, like, this feels so wrong, you know? Mm-hmm. And, like, in the first couple of months after my mother died, if I saw a movie about someone whose parent died, it'd be upsetting to me. But I, like, you know, people who I know who lost kids, who are parents whose children died, like, 20 years later, they can't ever watch something that has that content in it, because it will just be emotionally devastating to them.
Sure.
Because it's a reminder of this, you know, tragedy that, as we're taught, we being me and everybody else, not
sure,
you.
Sure, sure. Fair.
You're off on your mountain. That's fine.
Appreciate it.
But that, you know, that is one of those things that shouldn't happen. So, like, there's a lot we can say about content warnings, and I think we actually do get a lot of that into a lot of that in our last Kenobi episode. Mm-hmm. I'll probably revisit at some point. But I think that, to me, is why the content warning specifically about the killing of kids, as much as I am on board with this, like, let's maybe not have the, like, kids' life is the greatest in the world and everyone else's life not as important, I do get why that content warning is there, because I think that the way our society is built around these things, I get why that would be much more traumatic.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that's a fair thing to say, that, you know, on average, something like that is going to be more true. Like, losing a child is going to be, on average, more traumatic than losing a parent for most people.
Right.
Right. And that, that seeing something like that, maybe not even having lost a child, but maybe just having a child, right? Or or even just having kids that you're close with that you care about, right? Like nieces, nephews, cousins, whatever, students. I think I can understand how that's that feels like maybe that warrants something that something else doesn't warrant. I just feel that, like, I don't know, nobody cares about content warnings for the things that upset me, you know? Yeah. And it's like, I feel like, I think there a better system would just be probably a better version of, like, did the dog die? Because, like, I kind of looked at the website, I'm like, this could probably use some work, you know? But I appreciate the effort, I applaud the effort. And, you know, I just think that, like, it these types of things are usually, like, we want to have some specific thing because we think we're supposed to. Like, I kind of don't feel, you know, like they took the two towers out of Spider-Man, you know, the first Tobey Maguire Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, I just leave them in. Like, you know what I mean? And they were going to not name the two towers the two towers. And then they're like,
and you and I are speaking here as New Yorkers who spent an awful lot of time at the World Trade Center.
Yeah, we used to go play games. I almost got killed by something falling off the top of it one time, like a freaking ice chunk.
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, I saw
a mile away. I saw one of the planes with my own eyes.
Yeah, I walked there and saw the pillars of smoke and was like, huh, there used to be buildings there. It was very upsetting, you know, as much as, like, yes, the comedy special that I will never actually record would be called 911 is a joke, like the Public Enemy thing, you know, mm-hmm. but, like, with a slash. Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, there would be a disclaimer at the beginning of that, but it would be funny. but basically, because, like, it was 21 years ago and the United States has allowed it to dominate policy to the point of, like who won that one? Yeah. Not the U.S. The U.S. lost that not by getting attacked, but by responding exactly the way that was intended to, you know, the effect it created. So, like, nice job, people. Yeah, I can't wear my shoes in an airport in line anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I 100% there with you. And I think that's another thing that factors into this a lot is that, yeah, I'm – for anyone who doesn't know, there's a website called Does the Dog Die? Which does what I think it – I agree it could be much better, and I think it should be done, like, officially instead of just by, like, random fans watching these things. But the idea is that instead of saying that, like, okay, these issues warrant trigger warnings and these issues don't, like, instead of just like, look, here's all these different things that could trigger someone.
Right.
If you're concerned about being triggered, you go to the website and you say, yeah, like, for me it might be, you know, depictions of sexual assaults. For someone else it might be, like, yeah, seeing an animal be mm-hmm. mistreated. For someone else, it might be, you know, seeing a miscarriage or, like, you know, a still, you know, an infant death, you know, whatever it is. For someone else, it could be, like, having your house burned down because that's what happened to you. Like, trauma doesn't make any sense and it doesn't have to make any sense.
Right.
Triggers, we're talking about, like, being, I mean, like, actually, like, PTSD triggers, but just the things that are going to upset you because they remind you of trauma don't have to be logical.
Right.
And yeah, I love that idea of let everyone figure that out for themselves and give people that warning without it being a spoiler for everybody else.
Right.
And that was connected to something originally that I was talking about, but that I just don't remember at all now. So,
infant mortality. I do have a friend who had a 5-day-old who died, and mm-hmm. they post about it every year on the birthday, I believe. And, you know, and talk about it. And it's a thing that, you know, they talk about how a lot of people don't understand how that's, like, a big deal, like how that person could have mattered to them because they were only 5 days old. And that's, like, the opposite, right, of the, like, oh, well, that's not a person yet. And, like, you know, I get how, like, some people were like, oh, well, I don't want to kind of attach to a person until, like, I think they're going to make it, kind of. But, like, also how horrible that must be. I mean, I've never been through something
I
mean, like that.
I've always said I think that's one of the worst things about how politicized abortion and thus fetal life has become is that in my work, I met when I did counseling around these issues, I would often meet people who had had, you know, miscarriages at some point or stillbirths or something like that, where they felt afraid to talk about how much it affected them because it was like, am I therefore granting too much value to, you know, my fetus? Because for me, it felt this was a child I wanted, right. You know, and that kind of stuff. And
yeah.
And I think it also goes to kind of what we were saying before about like, it's easier to deal with something if you understand that it like, not that everything should happen, but that it does happen, you know, a lot. And that's one issue where people never talk about it to each other. So you often don't realize like, yeah, if you've had, you know, a miscarriage or something like that, often probably 8 other people you know have dealt with this, but no one talks about it.
Yeah.
So.
Which to me, I'll just say it seems like a reason to actually feature that in some fiction, you know, but I can also understand why. Like there's things that I see very specifically that I'm like, I would like to see that represented, but I do not want to watch it, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah. I mean, I don't think it even deals with an actual loss, but like the movie Up, you know, it's a Pixar movie. It's a fun movie about a talking dog later, but it has probably one of the most emotionally disturbing scenes that I think I've ever seen in a movie, let alone an animation movie, which is, you know, this family realizing that they're not going to be able to become pregnant.
Right.
And it was, I think it was very well done. I don't think it was manipulative. I think it was incredibly beautiful filmmaking. But I know people who are so upset that they didn't know that was going to happen going in because it devastated them.
Right. You know? Yeah,
and,
I could see that.
It's you're right. It's the representation matters, but also give people the chance to be like, nope, I know what that's like. I don't need to see it again.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, that's not just like picking and choosing whose tragedies matters and giving them warnings, but like, yeah, having a system that is more opt-in, I think, would be fantastic.
Exactly. One last question I'm going to ask you, Paul, and for anyone who thinks I'm about to be entirely insensitive, Paul and I have talked about this before, and Paul said he's happy talking about it. You know, you're someone who talks about how your father lost your father at a young age, and I know two of your absolute favorite characters, Batman and Daredevil, the same thing is true of them.
Yeah.
What is that? Have there been times when those stories weren't things you could watch, or were they cathartic in any way, or is it just totally unconnected?
I think it was never something that I felt like I couldn't watch. I wouldn't really use the word cathartic either. I would say that I do feel like I relate to those characters more than I would if that hadn't been my experience. And, you know, I think in general, I mean, I always thought we were meant to relate to superheroes, right? And, you know, I think the fact that so many superheroes lose one or more parents when they're young has actually made that like easier for me.
Yeah.
You know?
I can see that.
And like, and similarly, like Luke, and you know, at some point I was like, why don't any of these characters have parents? You know what I mean? Like when they're adults, like none of them. And to the point where I found myself writing characters that like never had parents. And then I was like, all right, well, maybe let's sometimes have some parents for some of these people, you know?
Right. Yeah. I'm guessing a big part of it is the like, just from a pure storytelling standpoint, keeping a secret identity while you have parents who knew you before you know, gets a lot harder. And then, you know, or it's a story like I would say that Clark Kent technically does not have parents, but he has adult figures who parented him, who were a major part of his life throughout his life, you know? And in some ways, therefore, he's not an orphan, I think, in the same way that like a Batman or many of these other characters are.
Yeah, I mean, Clark Kent is an orphan who was adopted at birth. And I mean, I would call them his parents, you know, like they're his adopted parents. His biological parents are dead. They got blown up with his entire planet, except for whoever was conveniently saved, who can then show up in later episodes. But you know,
it's kind of like the Jedi who escaped Order 66. There's as many as the plot demands.
Exactly as many as the plot demands. So, you know, I do think that, yeah, Clark Kent's a little different, right?
Yeah.
You know, whereas, like, there's a difference between Batman, and maybe the reason that Batman always felt the most relatable to me was, like, Batman did grow up in a house with one adult looking over him, you know?
Right.
And was, like, okay, You know, whereas like Daredevil was in an orphanage, right? He was, you know, and I think those are, you know, those are different experiences, I imagine. Right. Neither of those have been exactly my experience, but growing up in a place that was comfortable enough with, you know, one adult, that's my experience, right? So that kind of matches Batman.
Yeah, and it does make you wonder, like, why is Peter Parker raised by his aunt and uncle?
Right.
You know, and then his uncle, he's sort of both, because on the one hand, like, his parents are dead.
Yeah.
But then also, one of the two parental figures who raises him dies as part of his origin story.
Right.
And
I find that actually very relatable, you know, also.
Yeah.
Like, he's basically Aunt May, my mom.
Why isn't that just his mother and father, instead of it being his aunt and uncle, you know?
Right, yeah. That's a choice, right? And I think the choice is to add a little bit of separation. And I think with heroes, often, you know, it's the reason they kill off Kenobi in the Kenobi series. No, I'm just kidding. Obviously, that's the fakest of all fake spoilers, right? I'm not a fan of fake spoilers, but it's like, I mean, I don't know. Maybe they do in the last episode. Who knows? But I got to figure he makes it through to A New Hope, like, unless they're just going way off the rails.
I mean, that could explain the aging, if it's a clone Kenobi, but just right. The cloning is done badly.
Do you know the theory, like, Obi-Wan was like, this was like an old theory, Obi-Wan Kenobi was like Old Ben 1, and that it was like the Clone Wars, and so there were, you know, there was like other Old Bens, that he was a clone. Wow. And like, maybe that was going to be a story. Who knows? You know, obviously that's not where they went with it. But I do think that often they try and like remove all of the kind of people that, you know, the hero can go to for support, right? To kind of like kick the hero out, put them on their own, and then they have to like make it on their own and figure things out themselves. And so there's this hesitance to have characters who could serve too much as a mentor for too long, because I think there's an idea that that doesn't let the hero totally develop. That's one of my favorite things in one particular anime, actually, that's not exactly how it goes, and I kind of like that, you know.
At least in the MCU, there's definitely like, we never heard what happened to Ant-Man's parents. We never heard what happened to like Mr. and Mrs. Banner. We've never heard what happens to, you know, but they, that's the thing, is they just never appear, you know?
Right.
Most of the time, if we learn about someone's parents, it's because they died tragically when they were young, or they died in a way that was, they almost always die as part of the developing the plot of that character, you know, whether it's Iron Man or Natasha or, you know, Captain America, they just died because he missed 50 years of aging, but like...
No, what? Captain America, his parents were dead before, right? There was like that whole funeral thing.
Oh, you're right. Right? Yeah, okay.
Bucky's
you're right.
Like, I'm with you till the end of the line or something.
Yeah, yeah, Bucky's family kind of died. Okay, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I'm trying to think if there are any other... Are there any MCU characters who have living parents who have been on screen in any way, shape, or form?
Like, besides, like, Thanos. Well, I guess he didn't make it, but spoilers for Endgame. it's a good question. I mean, not Shang-Chi. Not a lot. I mean, I guess, you know, the Wasp, right?
Yeah.
And
but her mother was gone from
right. Exactly, she had that experience an hour months back. But like, yeah, it's just super standard. And I think it would be really nice. I had a story I was gonna write about one of, you know, this spy or something who was gonna have a whole secret life, whatever. But then he was gonna like drive up to the country and like go into some house. And, like, his parents were going to be like, oh, hi, so nice of you to visit. You know, it was just going to be, like, chilling with his parents, who were retired spies who now, like, lived off in the country. And there was going to be absolutely nothing about them getting endangered or, like, anything happening to them. Like, that was just going to be, you know, the like, secret life and, you know, the home life or whatever were just going to stay completely separate. And it was just going to be the kind of, like... sort of detox, like relaxing at the end of every episode kind of thing. Maybe I'll do that someday. I don't know.
That could be fun. You kind of had that with Hawkeye. And yeah, even after the Hawkeye show, you somewhat have that, although they kind of played with it a little
bit. They just got blipped a bit, just lost 5 years, became a homicidal, mass murdering, Punisher, basically.
And I'll say, just from the trailers of Ms. Marvel, it does, I mean, again, she's a teenage hero who's becoming a hero in that show, but at least just from the trailers, it does seem like she has a full family, and who knows where that's going to go.
Right. So.
All right. I think once again, let's start with one topic and hit as many as we can. It's a complete and total failure because you and I are just pompous windbags who can talk about pretty much anything. And that, yes, is a we that I will include you in.
I'm insulted. but also complimented at the same time.
Exactly. Where's other places that people can find what you're up to these days?
Yeah, Twitch. Every morning at 10 a.m., I talk about poker. Today, I made a spreadsheet with a lot of percentages on it. I'm sure that'll get everybody interested. And then I might Twitch some other stuff at some point. I'm Zen Madman there. I'm Zen Madman on Twitter, where I tweet random chess positions and stuff. And then we've got Zen Madman on YouTube and Madman Poker on YouTube. We're putting up some of these as videos, so you can check that out. And subscribing is super helpful.
We were both too lazy to get dressed up for today. So.
Yeah. Weren't feeling it is how I'm going to go. I'm not going to go with lazy. I'm going to say wasn't feeling it.
That's fair. We both got a lot going on.
Yeah,
so check out all that. I will say also on Paul's Twitter handle, account, you'll see them posting stuff about, their favorite Batman episodes and stuff like that. We get a lot of fun discussions about Star Wars. We've been getting a lot of great feedback, both about Kenobi stuff, but also other things, mostly by email. But feel free to post it on Twitter, post it on Facebook if you want us to get in discussions with you. We would love to do that. And, of course, you can find all the ways to contact us by going to theethicalpanda.com. There you'll find our Facebook, Twitter, email, all the ways to contact us, and including all the other podcasts I'm doing. I may have mentioned that I have a Star Wars podcast that's pretty busy right now. Star Wars Universe podcast. It's kind of good. I mean, the Kenobi numbers we're getting are fantastic. And it's great. But I do have some great stuff lined up for you back here on Superhero Ethics. I want to get these numbers up as well. We did a great episode on Stranger Things where, for some strange reason, one of our computers, the computer of one of our guests sped up quite a lot. So the audio is just all kind of out of sync. We have this other episode we're going to try and do on applying critical theory to the way we apply it, to the way we look at these things with a wonderful college professor who talks about this quite a lot. So I'm really looking forward to that. We do have a lot of great things coming up for you. And I was going to say to our Superhero Ethics fans, thank you for your patience. I know it's been a lot of Kenobi all the time. Thank you for sticking around. We are going to try and get these episodes out to you pretty regularly. I'm going to be going away. I'm doing some traveling this coming weekend. So I'm not positive we'll have another episode for next week, but I certainly hope we will. But either way, thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for continuing to be a great audience. And most importantly, as part of fandom, as fans, be excellent to each other.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only content.